Mr. Hayward, Reel 12. We're talking really about conditions of service when you're with the 2nd, 5th and 4th R Yeomanry at Cully between round about the 16th, 17th of June and the 23rd of June on landing in France. Cigarette ration, we'd come to that really. What about...
Yes, cigarettes, they were issued in tins of 50, and I'd say they came through about once a week. And
was that enough for you?
It probably was enough for me at the time, although sometimes, as we were given mail, sometimes people sent cigarettes through the post. They would often arrive rather squashed looking, but that didn't happen. Some chaps smoked a lot and got supplies sent from home.
You had about, so it's about 12 a day, you were 10 a day you were allowed, sorry, 16 a day.
Yes, yes.
That was enough.
That was probably enough for me. I was smoking at that time, but...
Had you smoked before you joined the army?
Only very occasionally. Even in those days, I found them a bit expensive for my pocket. So I wasn't a regular smoker.
Did most people smoke? In the army?
In the army, yes. Yes, I would say it was very popular, smoking in those days.
And what were the cigarettes like you got issued? Were they any good, or were they sort of shavings?
Oh, they were. The ones we had free issue were quite good. They would be things like Capstan or Goldflake, one of the well-known brands, Players possibly. Yes, they were certainly good brands.
And were you getting a rum ration at this stage?
No, we still didn't have any rum issued unless there was something special. It was something disastrous, like everybody got wet through at the same time. But I don't remember rum being issued in Normandy, possibly because the chaps, once they were free to wander about a bit, out of action, they would be raiding bombed buildings to see if there was any wine or liquor in the cellars.
Was there much of that going on at Cully? Or was that later?
I think a little bit went on at Cully amongst those that were daring enough to wander and explore the area a bit.
Did you do any of it?
I do remember, I think they pointed out that we all ought to go and have a look at a damaged German vehicle that had been hit by something, hit by a shell or other piercing round. It was lying at the side of the road in a village, which I think was called Brettville, which was nearby to Cully. And
what did you think of it?
Well,
what was it? Do you know what it was?
It was a tank, a German tank. Not one of the bigger ones. It was one of the earlier models, I think. And it was in a wet condition at the side of this village street. And we were all told to go and have a look at it to identify it and make whatever we could of it.
What did you think of it?
Well, I thought it... It looked to me as though it had been hit very easily. It looked as though it wasn't very sort of fearsome looking object. Nothing there to be frightened of.
Had you had any lessons in tank recognition? I mean, like a Panther or a Mark, a Tiger tank. I mean, had you been given any lessons in that, like as in air recognition? Had you given German tank or fighting vehicle recognition?
I don't remember being given lessons in that, possibly because I was a late arrival to the crew. I've no doubt the others went through all sorts of classes in that sort of thing. I remember more classes in aircraft recognition, but that was probably from Catterick Camp days.
Now, what about various aspects of camp life? What about latrines? How did they manage for that at Cully?
Latrines, yes, very primitive. They were hygienic, I suppose, because we had to go to a Hessian enclosed area where there was a trench dug, and a crude, heavy pole or branch of a tree was slung between tripods, and that's where we had to squat. That was the latrine. I suspect that the officers had a similar one, perhaps a little bit more private than ours, but I never saw any officers using ours. But that was it. And as far as rubbish was concerned, pits had to be dug, and they were positioned fairly close to the cook's truck, because they were the ones most likely to produce rubbish. So all the empty tins from the cooking processes had to be thrown into these pits and covered over eventually. So the camp at Cully had a very tidy pins.
Now, what about the actual French civilians? Were there any in the Cully area that you met?
I don't remember seeing any. There must have been some, but as the area had been passed in the battle and was probably considered fairly safe then, there must have been some villagers who had returned to their homes. But we mostly kept to our field where we were. But I think the regiment was in Southern Corps, and it was all very rural and pleasant. As I think I've said, it was like a Boy Scouts camp.
Now that began to stop, and you became tied up in the Epsom operation. Now we briefed before this. That was, I think, the 26th of June it started, or your main involvement in it started.
We must have been given some slight briefing that we were at last going into action, and I expect we began to feel a little bit nervous then about what it entailed. And I suppose one morning we woke up and told we were on the move. We would get on.
That was all the briefing you got?
Yes, we were told that we were going into action. And that we must pack everything. We must hold up our gear, get the camouflage nets folded up, tarpaulin folded up, all their kits stowed. And we must prepare to move off with everything we've got. We weren't told that we were likely to go back to Cully. We just told, that was the end of Cully.
Would you check the tank over or prepare, check your Browning, check the guns, check everything else in the tank before you set off?
I don't think we would worry too much. We would probably be told to do a last-minute check. Anybody that was sort of in the middle of a maintenance operation would be told to finish it off. But I think by that time, as we'd had several days of Cully, perhaps a week or so, we would not be too worried about the efficiency side. We'd be all ready.
Now, you were moving off. This was where you were basically going to go over the River Odon,
yes,
towards the Orne, and you were the B Company were leading the advance on Cherx. Now, not C H E U X.
Yes. B Squadron were leading, according to the account, and that was us.
But you wouldn't have known that at the time, or would you?
No, I wouldn't have particularly known that we were leading. I would assume that the other squadrons were scattered around on parallel front movements. Or even behind us.
So you just didn't know what was going on.
We must have obviously been the leading tank, because the troop commander was the leader of the troop. I don't remember seeing any other tanks ahead of me.
So this was on the approach to Cherx. How would you pronounce this?
I would say Cherx.
Cherx.
I wouldn't
and you were the leading tank all the way to Sherwood, were you, or just the initial approaches?
We were We would be the leading tank in our squadron because I don't remember seeing any others in front of us.
And you got right too sure?
We didn't actually get right to the village itself, but we got near to the village. It was on the way to the village that we encountered this French farmer who was out in his field just wandering up the hedge side, which seemed rather a strange thing to do with tanks ready for action. But anyway, the officer in charge of our tank, Lieutenant Dark, asked if anybody knew French, and I said I did, a schoolboy French. And he said, well, will you attract the attention of that Frenchman and ask him some questions? So I called him over, and the officer asked me to question him as to whereabouts of the enemy. And this Frenchman said, well, the enemy have gone long since, and I haven't seen them around here. But I suppose he didn't know exactly where they were gone to, but he seemed happy enough that they weren't in that area, which satisfied our officer. So the crew, I think, must have chirped up, what about some eggs? And so I asked the chap how many they deserve. So off he went down to the field side and came back with some in his cap. And we, as I've said earlier, we always had spare tins from the 14-man pack, so we presented him with some tins of whatever, you know, peas or cooked meats and that sort of thing. Possibly even, well, he didn't need any milk, but might have had the odd tin of butter or cheese or something. So we gave him whatever we could spare in return for the eggs, and he was pleased and went off again. Then we motored on.
Now, what sort of countryside was it, generally, that you were travelling through in this approach to Shur?
At that stage, it looked pretty normal, sort of rolling English countryside with hedges and fields. I don't remember any, at that point, seeing any sort of heavily forested areas. It was just farm grazing country, the sort you'd see. To see cattle in, grazing fields and hedges, and little farms here and there. And from then.
Now, it's there, you're not sure whether it's now or later, but as you remember, it's now that you had to cross a railway embankment, and there was a problem with this in the Sherman. Well, could you describe that? I think we'll, you know.
Yes. In regard to the French railway embankments in Normandy, there were rather steep angles, and a tank was quite capable with its tracks of climbing up onto these railway lines, which were mostly single track, and had no difficulty in getting across the track itself. But when you get to the other side of the embankment, you, before the tank actually starts to descend, about half the tank has to teeter over the edge, and at that point it will start to suddenly rock or come down. It can come down with quite a jolt because it's heavy, and the driver has to be extremely careful indeed not to put on too much acceleration at that point, because he could cause the tank to make a sudden movement and perhaps turn over.
Somersault.
So at that point, the crew were very nervous indeed, and very relieved when the tank started the downward movement on the other side. It was a very dangerous position to be in, because if any enemy guns were positioned on the other side of the embankment to guard any approach, they had a perfect shot right through the thin underside of the tank that could cause immense damage.
Now, another thing that you mentioned is that you were ordered to open fire, a test firing or something, in a cornfield. Do you recall that?
Yes. This may have been during the first day's movements, but it may not. My memory's not very good on that, but it was very early on, obviously, because I wasn't used to firing Browning gun in action, and I was asked to spray a cornfield. And on that occasion, there was another tank or two in front of us, possibly, or more obviously, I would say, on our 7th Squadron. So I went to spray the corn, but because that was my first shots fired in Normandy, I'd forgotten that the gun was on a spring, and I'd got to push it up to make it fire horizontally, or even downwards, you know, push it up even further to make it fire downwards. And I'd forgotten that, so my first shots went up in the air and alarmed some of the jets sticking with their heads sticking out of the turrets of the tanks nearby. So I had to get that right immediately, so I stopped firing, and fortunately nobody was injured, and managed to spray this corn. And shortly afterwards, a head popped up, and we got our first German prisoner. He came out of the corn, very, very nervous indeed, just a lad, very dirty looking, scruffy looking. But he got under his arm a loaf of black bread. And so we all scrambled out of the tank as we went on the move then.
Had the other tanks fired?
They had possibly, yes. I can't remember whether
okay.
the firing was going on, but that was just a command made by the officer to me as an individual.
So you got out of the tank, sorry.
We all got out of the tank. I don't think the officer did. I think just the crew all got out. The rest of the crew got out, and we surrounded this chap. And he looked very, very nervous indeed. And he was muttering something in German, but probably saying, "Don't kill me," or something like that. But anyway, Penman, our driver, had spotted this loaf under his arm and said, "You'll no be needing that noo." And he got hold of it and gave it a good gold kick and sent it flying away. And this German burst into tears. He was crying piteously because he thought we were going to starve him or kill him or something. What became of him, I don't know, but he was handed over to whoever was behind him.
Were there infantry near you then?
There must have been.
Or lorried infantry?
Even air infantry. I no doubt, but I didn't see any, but there would be, no doubt.
Because it must be difficult to take prisoners in the tank, that's it.
Yes, it was. Sometimes they were put on the back of the tank, but that would be a bit difficult if you were going into battle. So we would, through the officer, would probably have to dispose of this prisoner by some means.
Was he armed? Cause
I can't remember taking any arms off him. He was actually pulling a small gun. He got this small gun. Almost like a toy gun. It was mounted on wheels, probably about 18 inches in diameter. A very crude-looking object. It almost looked like one of these Napoleonic sort of war guns that you see in pictures, in miniature. But no doubt it was a very clever German weapon, an anti-tank gun of some kind. I haven't sort of delved into that to see what they had in that sort of line, but it certainly wasn't a bazooka, it was a small cannon, probably capable of firing some anti-tank missile.
But you didn't know what it was?
I didn't know what it was. Now, that's all I could see of it, it looked like a small miniature cannon.
Now, there's a story that, quite similar to that actually, about the regiment opening up on a cornfield, and it was actually rather unfortunate because what they got was a member of the Monmouthshire who was going to the toilet in the field and he was killed. Do you recall that at all? Are you aware of that story or do you know?
No, I don't know that story. No, that's interesting.
So it's not something that was part of your experience at all?
No.
Did you open fire at anything else during that period of the advance? I mean, I know you're not quite sure that was. You just think it was the advance to Sher, but anything else?
No, I don't remember using my machine gun again that day. We certainly went on a bit further. and encountered these burning church attempts. I gather that was part of the initial assault on Sher by another regiment who had these church attempts.
How were you feeling when you saw that? Because, I mean, burning church, it obviously happened fairly recently.
Yes, yes, there was a lot of smoke around in that rather large field area as we approached Sher. And this rather alarmed us. We were immediately on our mettle, you know, we were very cautious and on the alert for anything that happened. And of course it did start to happen. The minute we got a bit beyond these burning church halls, things did start to happen. A lot of shelling going on. And because it was rather fierce, and we'd been on the move quite a while then, by that time it must have been into the afternoon, I would imagine, and I've only found out afterwards by reading the accounts that we were taken out. But before we were taken out...
B Company, you mean, or...?
B Squadron, yes. We were taken out and put into reserve, as I gather from the accounts. But I didn't know at that time.
And the other squadrons took over, I believe, A and C.
A and C took over. So just before that had happened, occurred the incident I described about my being frozen with fear.
Now, could you tell, what was it, you'd come under German shell fire. Now, this would be your first time under fire. What was it, I mean, were you battened down in the tank, and what was it like under German shrapnel or shell fire, that, in the tank?
Under shrapnel fire, once I'd heard the shrapnel hitting the tank and not apparently doing any damage, I didn't feel too fearful of what could happen from that point of view. But when I thought about it, I thought, well, if they can fire shrapnel at us, they can also fire these armour-piercing shells at us. And fortunately, we weren't hit by one of those, but they were shelling and producing shrapnel, which alarmed me, because I was asked to get out.
Hang on, what was it like with shrapnel hitting the outside of the tank? I mean, how loud was it? Did it cause any bits to detach on the inside?
No, I didn't have that sensation that anything was getting detached inside the tank. I could sense that whatever was hitting the tank outside was probably making some impression in the metal, but only in the form of dents or scratches.
How loud was it?
I suppose a bit like the sound of hail on a shed roof.
That much?
Yes, at times, yes.
And what could you see? Were you looking through your periscope?
I would be. I'd certainly be battened down and using the periscope.
And what could you see on that battlefield? Could you see any sign at all of where the Germans were, or was it just really an empty field? Or
I could see no sign of the Germans, no. I might have had the luck to see perhaps the occasional shot fired. You would see, you know, if you were facing a gun, a large gun, you could certainly see the muzzle flash. I might have spotted that occasionally from a distance, but nothing was visible. To me, it was just a sort of a gently sloping field area with either a wood or a thick hedge on our left and a sort of a distant hedge and trees over on the right at the top. And that, I gather, was probably the approach to the village itself.
And were any tanks of your B squadron in front of you, or were you still the lead tank, or were you in a line, or...?
I think we were still the lead tank. I can't remember anything in front of us particularly.
And you would be in a line, would you?
I would say that at that point we were in a line alongside this hedge.
And were you moving or were you static?
We were gently moving. We were gently moving very, very slowly. And the officer was obviously observing.
Would he be out of the top or would he be using his periscope?
I think he would probably be in a sort of position where the flaps were up and his head was between the flaps, and hoping that he would get some protection there, but he'd be using his field glasses.
Now, Then this incident happened where you feel you showed your inexperience. Could you tell me in as much detail as possible of what exactly happened and how you felt at the time?
Yes. We'd probably been shelled for perhaps 10 minutes or so, 10 minutes, quarter of an hour. And this was still going on when the officer had spotted that some of our gear on the back of the tank, the canvas or other stuff, was smouldering and had obviously been hit by some hot metal. He then asked me to get out of the tank and put it out. He said, stamp it out, get out and stamp it out. But as this shelling was still going on and the tank being peppered, so their shelling was pretty accurate, I didn't really want to. I thought, well, I was going to inevitably get wounded. I wouldn't be much good to anybody. I might even get killed. And I was frightened to death, literally frightened to death, and frozen with horror at the idea of getting out of the tank while the shrapnel was still hitting it. So, from my memory, I just sat there, frozen in horror at the idea, not knowing what to say, because I was a member of the crew and subject to orders. So, in effect, I was disobeying an order, even though I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything. But after a second or two, after this silence, there was also silence from outside. The shrapnel had ceased, and at that point, the officer asked the driver to get out, which caused me some concern, because I thought, well, it's really been me, but I'm still in a state of shock at the idea. And Penman got out and stepped it out and was quickly back in again uninjured. He was fine. But I did feel very bad about it, I felt.
Had the officer repeated the order to you?
No, he only said it once. He didn't say anything else to me. He didn't reprimand me or say anything.
Had he realised you had heard, do you think? Or is it conceivable you could not have heard? Was it on through the communications?
That is a good point. That is a good point. That is conceivable, but I think he would have been very cross with me if I'd had my earphones off at the time.
So the order came through your earphones?
Yes. I mean, we were all supposed to be receiving messages.
And so how would he give you the order? I mean, did he just say, Hayward, or driver Hayward? What would he say?
I would imagine he'd say, he might have used the expression, Bo Gunner, Hayward, get out and stamp out the flyer.
So there was no question of him thinking you'd either heard or not heard. I mean, you either have your headphones on and heard, or you hadn't got your headphones on, which was almost as bad.
I hadn't thought of that, Andrew. I mean, those intercom sets were very good. I suppose occasionally they gave trouble if somebody hadn't put the connections in properly in the main set. But everybody could get the messages, all right, in normal circumstances. And I certainly hadn't thought of the idea that he might have thought I hadn't heard. I certainly didn't say anything because I was too shaken.
It sounds like you just froze.
I did, yes. Just froze in horror. But the idea of getting out while this shrapnel was still hitting me.
Had you been scared before he said that? Or was it sort of like a shock and then the state of fear came upon you? Or were you already scared, badly scared?
I think we'd started to become scared at the sight of those burning churchyards. At that point, we realised we were in battle. That we were actually involved. I mean, up to the time when we'd met the French farmer and I sprayed the corn and we flushed out this German, I don't think we seriously thought that we were quite near the front line there. We thought this German was probably just a more scattered, left behind chap. It wasn't until we got to the area of the Churchills that we really began to feel a bit nervous.